of criminal episode and a transaction, and I'm not quite clear on what it all is.
Senator, first of all, with respect to the same act and the same transaction, the cases in Oregon, up until the fairly recent case of State versus Brown, had used just the same evidence test or the same transaction test. The Brown case, although it goes into the same kind of rationale.
Brown isn't discussed in here.
Well, we cite it, that's all. But Brown was decided after our draft. The Brown case does cite our draft, which was a tentative draft at that time. The approach that's taken here is what's called the compulsory joinder test. And Brown does apply the compulsory joinder test.
Is that all lesser included crimes?
Yes, it does. It includes any crime that, of course, we use what we call a criminal episode.
Yeah.
And it would include any crime that under this test is under the circumstance of the crime, the time, place, and circumstance are so joined that. It could be held to be aimed at accomplishing a single criminal objective. Now, the Brown case says essentially the same thing, except they still use the old language, the same act or transaction, which we felt was not a satisfactory kind of language. Because under the Brown case, it doesn't tell you what an act is or what a transaction is. We attempt to, under criminal episode, to have at least some guidelines for the courts to follow. And we're not suggesting that this prohibits prosecution for more than one offense growing out of the same criminal episode. What this draft would require, however, is for the state to prosecute, with certain limited exceptions, for all of these offenses at the same time. Or would they later be barred under former jeopardy?
Well, what if there's A and B and later, 6 months later, he dies? Does the state wait then until he dies?
Yeah, this kind of situation would be an exception under Section 27. Under sub 2, say no person shall be separately prosecuted for two or more offenses based upon the same criminal episode if the several offenses are reasonably known to the prosecutor at the time of commencement of the first prosecution. In other words, if...
Well, now, there's been a lot of problem with our making 0.15 a crime. The police officers are citing for DUIL in 0.15. This authorizes that, doesn't it?
Well, this doesn't really answer that question. It would authorize a prosecution for both. The problem that has arisen under that 1.5 statute is not a question of whether you've got two or more criminal offenses growing out of the same transaction, but whether or not, as a matter of legislative policy and intent, you meant to say that this conduct constituted two offenses.
I didn't mean to say that.
No, but I mean that's the question. That's the way I understand what the problem has arisen. It's whether the legislature intended one act, say, of driving under the influence, if the breathalyzer, the blood alcohol, showed a 0.15, that you could prosecute for both.
Well,
this doesn't really solve that problem, Senator.
Yeah, but 26 enhances it, doesn't it? Sub 2? Wouldn't
it doesn't enhance, it doesn't change what the present law is.
Couldn't you be charged with larceny and with shoplifting both?
Well, of course there you get into a separate question. About carving offenses and larceny and shoplifting are so similar. In fact, larceny and shoplifting are the same crime under the new criminal code because we don't have a separate crime of shoplifting. You could run into the problem of having a shoplifting charge brought under a municipal ordinance, however, and a state charge being brought under the criminal code, which still gets into another question.
And you can't plead double jeopardy there in the municipal court. Is that right?
That's right. My understanding of the current law. In earlier drafts, we attempted to deal with this problem about the multiple.
I saw him, but I thought he said he had it.
The multiple prosecutions in different jurisdictions.
I know.
We finally pretty much gave up on trying to solve that question. Basically, with respect to subsection 3, or subsection 2 of section 26, I don't think it enhances that. It doesn't change it. And in other words, if you think it should be the policy of the legislature to prohibit absolutely prosecution for more than one act out of the same criminal episode, this would not do that. I submit, though, that certainly the commission did not think that is sound policy.
But if you charge the higher, can't the jury find a lesser included, or can't you give instructions on a lesser included offense?
Oh, sure. Yeah, and under Section 27, you see, under Sub 3, you see, we say if a person is prosecuted for an offense consisting of different degrees, and then we go on down, a finding of guilty of a lesser included offense is an acquittal of the greater inclusive offense. And Sub 3, as I recall, does not change the existing law. I think that's present rule. And certainly you'd be allowed to give instructions on lesser included offenses, and a conviction of any of those would be a bar under Section 27 to a prosecution for any other offense, whether it's a greater or a lesser offense arising out of that prosecution. The question, getting back to the .15, though, is that the difficulty I have with that is that that's assuming that one is a lesser included offense of the other. And I'm not, my own personal view, I don't see how a DUIL with less than a 1.5 can be a lesser included offense of the other statute. Because
well,
it requires
say
more elements.
Say a guy has a .18 and we get in a different bill that solved this problem of two citations. Coming over to this is going to conflict with it, isn't it? Isn't Sub 2, if we do solve that problem, just going to put us right back where we came from?
I don't think so. I don't think we're talking about the same thing.
Well, I'd like to ask the question with a little different point of view. In 26.2, we're talking about an episode. And on 27, too, it looks like we're talking about... there must be a difference there. If not, they're contradictory, as I see it. And maybe if we explain the contradiction, then maybe we can clear this up.
Yeah, an episode and offense are not clear. An episode is compulsory joinder, is that right?
Well, an episode is made up of offenses for the purposes of former jeopardy. An offense is just one part of criminal episode. Because we require a criminal episode to include at least one offense, and it could include more. And under sub 2 of section 27, we again say, shall be separately prosecuted for two or more offenses based upon the same criminal episode. So...
Well, doesn't that contradict 26.2?
No, I don't think so. No, because 26.2 is a statement with respect to offense. If you look down into 26.3, then offense becomes pertinent because of the definition of 26.4, rather, because of the definition of criminal episode.
Well, it seems like what 27.2 is saying is they can't be separately prosecuted. It means you've got to have one trial for all of the offenses growing out of the same episode.
It meets the test of criminal episode. If you're going to prosecute for more than one offense, you've got to do it in one trial.
Well, I get back to this DUIO. It's the same liquor, the same man, the same car, at the same time. I don't see the car.
The thing is there, though, is do you have two offenses? And... like I said, this doesn't answer that because the assumption has been made in some courts, what I've been told, that you do have two offenses. My feeling is that you don't have more than one offense because legislature intended that to be either one or the other in that kind of situation, either a 1-5 violation or a DUIL, but not both.
Senator Burns.
The way that started out, Senator Hoyt, was that they had it in there that 0.10 would be a presumption, 0.15 would be a conclusive presumption. That's the way it started out. A legislator was walking down the street and bumped into a Supreme Court justice and asked him a question, which he had no background in traffic offenses at all, and he opined, said what he thought it amounted to, and so it came back and that legislator quoted the Supreme Court justice, and therefore it was amended to make it two separate offenses because he said you couldn't have a conclusive presumption. He said it was unconstitutional. Well, that constitutional prohibition pertains only to crimes where their intent is involved. In traffic offenses, no intent is necessary. So that's how that thing got screwed up. But I think the way the law ended up being written, that is clearly two separate offenses because one says you have to be driving under the influence of alcohol. The 0.15 doesn't say you have to be driving under the influence of alcohol. It says you have a breathalyzer of 0.15 or more.
Yeah.
So they are separate offenses, but it wasn't the intent of the legislature for them to be separate offenses.
As a matter of fact, the original House bill provided that that was just one way of committing the crime of driving under the influence.
But those are one episode, are they not?
Certainly that would be one episode.
Both driving under the influence and having 0.15.
Yes. Absolutely.
So what you really said was that these two don't resolve that particular problem.
No, they don't.
Okay, then I'm
with you. Is this a joinder statute in addition to dealing with jeopardy?
Well, it's a joinder way of dealing with jeopardy. It's a mandatory or compulsory joinder. In other words, as far as joinder of offenses, the prosecutor would have no choice if sub 4 existed. We say under sub 4, section 26. he would have no choice if he were going to bring prosecution for more than one offense. He would have to bring it all at one time. So it is a joinder statute to that extent, because it's a joinder way of dealing with the question of former jeopardy, which is what State versus Brown does. And it's a model. It's a model code approach. And also we cite some other, we cite the New York criminal procedure law. They use a compulsory joinder approach.
For Jeopardy, on page 16. If you steal a car owned by a husband and wife, that's two offenses.
Well, if it's jointly owned, I don't think you would. No.
Here you are. Relationship to existing law, 1, 2, 3, fourth paragraph. The effect of this section and the last of it, each victim represents a separate offense.
Well, I don't think any more so than under existing law. They jointly own it. They're both, you know, the purposes of theft. The owner is both.
Well, it says when property belonging to several people is stolen, each victim represents a separate offense.
Why would they want that in there anyway? What are they trying to apply that to? What situation?
Where are you reading?
I'm on page 17 of the book on subsection C, relationship to existing law, the 1, 2, 3, 4th paragraph. As pointed out to be on 19, where it says that if the generally in a crime against persons, each victim represents a separate crime, whereas only one crime is committed if the crime is only against the property of several persons. But that's referring back to, that's under the, no, that's right.
Well, what we're trying to get at here is, say, under a robbery, where your defendant has held up two or more victims,
yeah,
in the same episode, and has committed the crime of robbery against each. You have a separate victim, you have a separate robbery, and the defendant could be convicted for the, prosecuted for the robbery of A, prosecuted for the robbery of B.
Okay.
If he's armed, you got an assault against each one.
What does concatenated mean?
Well, that's court language, and that's why we went to so joined. It means joined and closely related. So we use the language so joined in time, place, and circumstance. Thought the other was, we weren't quite sure we could spell it correctly.
from the comments, solicitation and conspiracy are included in the substantive crime list.
Yes. And we provide there the, you know, under inchoate crimes, you can't, under this, you can't prosecute and convict for solicitation, attempt, and conspiracy. You're talking about the same offense.
I'm just going ahead. If anybody on the committee wants to raise any,
you're on section 128.
I'm on 28. Does anyone have a question before that? I don't remember who it was. I think it was the criminal law committee mentioned that in 28 in sub 1. That it should include in arrest, a motion in arrest of a judgment or a judgment of acquittal.
Criminal law committee. Oh, you mean from last session?
No, that testified this time.
Was the Oregon State Bar.
Oh, the bar.
I think that's right.
Handbooks, the legislative council made for the criminal code predating the 71 session. They have the procedural criminal code in it too. I've got it one in my office in Portland. I wonder if they have any extra copies.
I don't know.
You know what
they,
I mean?
We asked.
We checked and they're out of print and they don't have any extra copies.
Yeah, well, they're out of date as to the substantive.
Yeah.
I'll get it. Yeah, okay.
Does anybody think that it's necessary to include those? What do you think, Don?
Pardon me? Page 21.
On section 28, should a judgment of acquittal be... that wouldn't seem the proper place to me, a judgment of acquittal or an arrest of judgment.
Trying to see if I had anything here on what materials the bar committee proposed.
Well, what was the recommendation, Madam Chairman?
That the way I have it written down, I may have been in error. Is that section 28 should also contain a judgment of acquittal or an arrest of judgment, and that doesn't seem logical.
Well, what are they saying, that jeopardy shouldn't attach if there's been a judgment of acquittal?
Yeah, it
well,
like
I wouldn't
it should
agree
go
to that.
7 to me.
I wouldn't agree to that. You could prosecute somebody, they could be acquitted, and then you could re-indict them.
Yeah.
Well, we rejected that in the commission. Now, in arrest of judgment, where a jury returns a verdict of guilty, and the court sets it aside like you do in a civil case, is that what you're talking about?
Well, there seems to me the discussion that occurred in the bar committee was that it wasn't... Well, we just say by motion, it doesn't say what kind of motion. They may have wanted clarification on that, but I'll be darned if I can find anything in my still rooms.
Well, I think it's dangerous to have a
arrest of judgment stuck in there.
Yeah, I do too.
If you want a motion, I move we reject them.
No, I don't think we need a motion.
Well, we note in our commentary, ORS 136.820 states the effect of granting a motion and arrest of judgment is to place defendant in the same situation which he was before the indictment.
Where are you?
That's
please.
On page 22 under the second paragraph, relationship to existing law. Restates Oregon law that jeopardy may be annulled by consent or motion of defendant. And it could be that they felt that we should indicate that's what we're talking about rather than just leaving it with the mere statement by motion. Have other motions other than just a motion and arrest of judgment that would have the effect of annulling any jeopardy that it may have enhanced.
I might mention to the committee that my plan, unless you have objection to it, is to just adopt the bill article by article unless I think there's controversy over a particular section, where we'll take a vote on that particular section.
Statement made by the bar committee, and I dealing with Article 1, and I don't see anything in there about that section. they do propose an amendment under the venue provisions. And then they say this committee has specifically considered the advisability of codifying the law of former jeopardy. Some of this material is already in the statute, so we believe that the additional definitions and rules proposed in the code are worthwhile. And unless there was some subsequent matter submitted by the bar committee that I don't have here.
Did I understand you see your objection?
But just for the record, I think
no.
Insertion of a motion of set aside.
Bar committee.
Or a motion in arrest of judgment, if it were stated in this section, would not be contrary to existing law.
This is
okay. You note in the commentary that sub 4 of section 28 is new. Do you want to make a comment about that? I guess you already have when we talked about joinder.
Well, yeah, when the subsequent prosecution was for an offense which was not consummated when the former prosecution began. This would go back to your earlier question, say you had an assault or some crime that in which the victim later died. The offense would not have been consummated until the death of the victim. So sub 4 of section 28 would clarify that and so that the later prosecution would be allowed.
That means you can convict him of armed robbery, and then if the guy died, you can convict him of murder.
Yes.
What section is that?
That's
28 sub 4.
28 4.
And 29 is existing law, is that right?
Yes, entirely taken from 135.89. Except we use accusatory instrument as an indictment.
Well, wait a minute, you say in the commentary that section 29 sets forth three more situations for improper and no different.
Yes.
So it's not existing law?
No, it is existing law. We just put it in a different, in a separate section. Because here we call it proceedings not constituting an acquittal. And
well, what does it mean when it says three more situations?
Well, in addition to what we've set out under Section 28, when a previous prosecution
section
is not a bar to a subsequent prosecution.
Okay.
Do the committee members have any further questions on Article 1? If you remember on the first, Friday, when we were working this on the definitions on page 2 of the book, page 1 of the bill, I guess, we substituted probable cause for reasonable cause. It's on page 3 of the bill. Wait a minute. Yeah, it's on line 33. Page 3 of the bill, line 33. And Mr. DeWinter, among your materials, has set forth a definition of probable cause. If you would look at that, please. His amendment refers to the bill, not to the...
Was this in our packet?
Is there any discussion of the proposed amendment by Mr. DeWinter? Don, do you see it? Do you have a copy?
Well, I saw it earlier today. number 2.
I move we adopt the amendment.
It's been moved that we adopt Mr. DeWinter's amendment defining probable cause, which will go in the bill on page 3 at line 33. Discussion.
I'd like to ask Senator Burns, does this do violence to some of the things you were talking about?
Well, I think, Madam Chairman, that I agreed at the last meeting to go ahead and agree to the substitution of probable rather than reasonable because of the cases that have been handed down defining the term. And what you're doing is you're using the classic preliminary hearing bindover test. More likely than not, an offense has been committed and the person to be arrested is committed. But that's a classic definition of probable cause. I think it's all right. I agree to you.
Is there further discussion? Clerk, call roll on the amendment.
Senator John Boone?
Aye.
Senator Keith Stearns?
Aye.
Senator Ivers?
Aye.
Senator Boyd?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Aye. I think that's the only matter in Article 1.
Senator Brown, now I noticed with respect to the venue statute, statutes, that the bar committee did propose an amendment there, section 15 of Article 1.
You are...
They proposed a subsection 12.
You're looking at the book again, though.
Are you in the book or the bill?
Yeah, either one. The numbers are the same.
Yeah, they are. That's right.
Now, this is supplement to oral testimony in Senate Bill 80, Articles 1 to 5, 7 to 9, 11, from Larry Durer, the chairman of the Criminal Law and Procedure Committee. Mm-hmm. And on page 1 of this supplement, about three-quarters of the way down the page.
Oh, you look at this stuff here.
Excuse me, Madam Chairman, in this list of amendments, within the packet, it begins Article 1 testimony. If you turn back to the fourth page in, it's headed page 2. About the middle of the page is the statement of the amendment.
What they're trying to get at, of course, that we allow aggregation. Aggregation is allowed under the substantive code to get to the $200 amount. In other words, where you have attacking $75 here and $75 there. And all this is attempting to do is to allow you to, if this involves more than one county, that you try in any one of the counties. This was a bar committee recommendation. Was proposed to add subsection 12 and 3.
Oh, it really doesn't affect the... I see. That you could try all the offenses.
Yeah, if the offense is theft and the offense consists of an aggregate transaction involving more than one county, trial of the offense may be held in any county which one of the acts of theft was committed. I voted for that in the bar committee.
Is this number 12?
I think it's consistent with the substantive code.
Now I'm straight out. Those on the bottom of page 12 are those. They're not right here, number 12.
I'm going to remember.
Senator Smith moves. That section 12 of the bill on page
section 15 on page 12, I think.
Section 15
on the yellow book.
No, I'm referring to the bill.
Page 8.
Senator Smith moves that page 8 of the bill under the section regarding place of trial special provisions that there be added a section 12 which states if the offense is theft and the offense consists of an aggregate transaction involving more than one county, trial of the offense may be held in any county in which one of the acts of theft was committed. Discussion?
I just know how different this is from present law.
Well, the criminal code is amended in 1971, provided, and this was an amendment that came out of the committees, provided that since we were raising the amount of property that could be stolen before the crime became a felony, that is, it used to be $75 or more was a felony, and we raised that upward to $200. that we should permit packing, and
yes,
that is...
Yes, I remember that.
All right.
But then, but couldn't they prosecute in any county at that time?
I think this is designed to clear up an ambiguity that clearly exists where the tacking is part in one county and part in the other.
Well, I think they'd have to try them separately under present law in each county for what was stolen in that county.
In other words, we didn't finish our work last time. Thank you.
So this would be a change from present law.
It was what was intended last time.
Well, I understood what I did.
Well, let me say this.
As I understand, this doesn't create anything new as far as the substantive crime or anything else. It just clarifies as to that they can try it in any one of the counties.
Yeah.
Where
try it as a felony.
But we allowed tacking before.
That was
we didn't change the venue statute.
That's oversight.
Yes. That's
I think you could make a strong argument under what we propose in subsection 7 now.
Yeah.
Which is very similar to ORS 131350.
ORS 1?
131350. It says, first, I think we did amend that statute last time to insert the word theft, replace the theft for larceny.
Well, where we say maybe, yeah, but that seems to be mutually exclusive.
A person who commits theft, burglary, or robbery may be tried in any county in which he exerts control of the property that is the subject of the crime. I think you could make an argument that the property that's the subject of the crime is all the property that's involved in the aggregate transaction.
I think you agree that this.
I think it would clarify, yes. And I don't think I would agree that it changes existing law.
I said it's designed to clear up an ambiguity that exists in present law.
All right, that done that.
Well, Bob, do you want to state your intent again?
Well, I want to clear up what you guys filed up last session.
Thank you.
Since I wasn't on the committee, of course, it could have never happened had I been here. However, I assume that what I was getting at is already in law, that you could aggregate the offenses and try them in one county to a felony. Is that right?
No.
That's already existing law.
Well, yeah, under 131350 of the properties there, you can try them in the county where the property is.
Just because he's in the contract, he still doesn't have the cattle.
Well, I moved the language that's quoted here. What the hell is it?
You don't care what it means.
No, it sounds awful good.
Get a calf in Harney, one in Malheur, and one in Lake County.
That's what I'm figuring on.
Madam Chair,
Senator Keith Burns.
I think we ought to look at section 23 of the in the book. Well, I didn't say it was on the expenses.
Well, we've got a vote on Senator Smith's amendment. Does this relate?
I think it does.
Okay.
The expenses
in the system, Canada, perhaps has some expenses paid to be as a travel across the state for the attorney to defend himself. I put him under a serious handicap. The district attorney chose which county he's going to try the case.
Could move for change of venue, though.
Pardon me?
He could move for a change.
Who could?
The defendant.
I wanted to raise it.
Under section 20, if I could speak to that.
We were looking at 23.
Yes, I know, but I think section 20 has a bearing on that because it allows change of venue for other than prejudice, which is dealt with in section 19, for the convenience of parties and witnesses and in the interest of justice. In other words, under an aggregate theory, where Marion County is involved and say Deschutes County and some other county some distance away. The defendant, I think, could move for a change of venue under Section 20 and not even have to show prejudice in order to have the court allow the change of venue.
So end of my discussion.
Question on the motion, Madam Chairman.
Clerk, call the roll.
Senator John Green.
Aye.
Senator Keith.
Aye.
Senator Ivers.
Aye.
Senator White.
Aye.
Senator Smith.
Aye.
Madam Chairman.
Aye.
I move Article 1 be approved as amended.
It's been moved that Article 1 be accepted as amended. Discussion. What's the date?
12.
Clerk, call the roll.
Senator John Green.
Aye.
Senator Keith.
Aye.
Senator Ivers.
Aye.
Senator Boyd.
Aye.
Senator Smith.
Aye.
Madam Chairman.
Aye. Then turning to section, or Article 2, Investigation and Prevention of Crime, that's on page 24 in the book and 12 in the bill. The motion which was passed last time was that wherever reasonable cause appears, that it will be substituted by probable cause. But we still have in this section a number of things based on reasonably suspects. There is a definition of reasonably suspects in number 4. Do you see any problem with that, Don, with having probable cause and reasonably suspects?
None at all. I think that we're talking about a less than arrest situation. And in our definition of arrest, we also indicate, again, that a stop is defined in Section 30 is not an arrest. This reasonably suspects language is consistent with Terry versus Ohio, where they were talking about reasonable suspicion to make the arrest rather than he reasonably believes or reasonable suspicion to make the stop, as opposed to the officer reasonably believing that a crime has been committed. And I think here reasonably is properly used and is not in conflict with the definition of probable cause.
Well, this is all new. Is that correct?
It's all new, yes. It's all new with respect to Oregon statutes. Yeah.
The main thing is distinguishing between the definition of stop and arrest, right?
Yes.
And you say on page 25 in the comment that it's based on less than probable cause.
Yes.
Where is that?
Right here.
Okay. Is this the full?
Yes. We say less than probable cause or what is sometimes called reasonable suspicion. We just use the verb form rather than the noun.
What was the discussion on the commission on this? This seems to come up usually in a lot of it in automobile cases where the headlight is out or something else.
That would be a violation that would not be subject to the provisions of 31, not within the parameter of stop and frisk.
You say
right?
What?
Right.
Felony? It only applies to a felony?
Crime. Crime.
It would have to be an offense that's punishable by imprisonment to come under 31. That's correct.
Well, if he's driving erratically, the police officer could reasonably believe that he was intoxicated, and for that he could be incarcerated.
Right.
Well, no. This doesn't allow incarceration. This.
No, no. That's, I'm going back to what John said. The type of offense they could apply this to. What is it? Section 30, 31, and 32 is all brand new law, right? Codification.
Yes.
33 is old law with amendment.
Yes.
Well, on 24 in the commentary 25, you repeated the definition of crime. Crime is either a felony or a misdemeanor.
Problems. Over on section 31, peace officer reasonably suspects the person has committed or is about to commit a crime. That's certainly a very subjective type of reason. How many sections are there for this thing anyway?
Not very long.
Well, there was, Madam Chairman, there was discussion. There's discussion on the commission that this proposed section doesn't do any more than what the officers presently have a right to do under Perry versus Ohio anyway. Is that not correct?
Yes, that's correct.
That discusses or is about to commit a crime.
As it says on the middle of page 25, the rationale in the Terry decision.
Which column?
It's the first column, two paragraphs up from the top of set 31. Quote, the sole justification of the search in the present situation is the protection of the police officers. I think the genesis of this is to provide the police officer with some protection.
And, well, now on page 26, we quote directly from Perry versus Ohio, the relationship to existing law, the third paragraph. Where a police officer observes unusual conduct which leads him reasonably to conclude, in light of his experience, that criminal activity may be afoot. Now, we took language instead of saying may be afoot to saying, as we stated under section 31, has committed or is about to commit. The about to commit phrase would be the counterpart of what the Supreme Court in Terry said, criminal activity may be afoot. They did not require under Terry that a crime had been committed. In fact, that was one of the bases for the Terry opinion, was that this is if there's some reasonable suspicion that the person that the officer is about to stop is involved in criminal conduct, it doesn't require that a crime has actually been committed or that he have reasonable belief, because then you'd have probable cause to make an arrest. Here, Terry versus Ohio is more of a crime prevention oriented decision rather than an arrest after the fact of commission of an offense. And it does allow the stop if he reasonably suspects. I know that there has, that this was objected to, and I can't recall, it wasn't the bar committee, but I know that there was...
The bar committee did object to this hearing.
Did they object to about to come in? Okay, well, I stand corrected.
That was
Milbank. Didn't he represent the bar committee here?
My role. He was simply representing himself.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
He was past chairman of the bar committee on criminal proceedings.
Okay, Milbank, I thought he was representing the bar.
Where is that, John? I don't...
31.
On the bill, it's page 13.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, where is the objection? Do we have it in amendment form?
No, Madam Chairman, it wasn't submitted in writing.
Okay.
Well, in a matter of practice, this about to commit is what the officer does today. He doesn't wait for the guy to get shot before he grabs his gun.
Well, Senator, that was our view on the commission, that's what Terry versus Ohio allows an officer to do now.
What were the facts in Terry versus Ohio? What was going on? Criminal activity and drugs? Or?
Yeah, it was. It was a narcotics.
Well, they didn't... did they uphold the activity in that case?
Yes. They upheld the... the stop, and they upheld the frisk, and on the basis that this did not constitute an arrest, the action that was taken by the officer in the Terry case.
Well, boy, the way I have read that case, but the way this relates here, it says here, it looked like they didn't. It says the Supreme Court of the United States held that the stopping of a person was, in fact, a seizure of that person, and within the Fourth Amendment protection of unreasonable search and seizure. However, the court stated that the stopping of a person may be justified or reasonable.
There is a distinction between the rationale applied in Terry on a stop and frisk and the prerogative to search incident to search incident to an arrest. In other words, now it's been a long time since I've read Terry, but when you speak to seizure there, Keith, it doesn't rise to the dignity of seizure.
Well, they said it was a seizure of the person.
All right.
What Terry said, a seizure of the person.
Okay, but it's not a... It doesn't give them the right to search incident to arrest because it doesn't reach the dignity of an arrest.
And that's why they use the term frisk, which would be just the external pat-down of the suspect for the... If, after the stop, the officer reasonably suspects again that the defendant may be armed with a weapon, then he can pat him down. This does not give the officer right to a full-blown search of that person that would be the same kind of search as would accompany an arrest, because no arrest has been made.
But when he finds the gun, what happens?
He's committed in his presence.
Yeah, then you would...
This sounds like what an infamous predecessor of mine from Benton County did. In gambling. He said that you couldn't have a lottery, but you could have a meet. And so now we have paramutuals. And it sounds like the same kind of gobbledygook.
I thought you were the first representative.
Not the first bad one. No, we've had others.
I thought you've been here since you became a counselor.
I've been trying to undo some of his stuff ever since with no success.
I'll help you.
Well,
you.
Madam Chairman. Let's talk about
what you
policy.
Say is different from what Don said.
Don't think so.
You're saying that this is substantially for the safety of the officer.
Right. That's right. And I'm saying that as a matter of public policy, my fears were quieted when the commission took violations out of the ambit here, because the biggest abuse we have of this kind of thing is where they pick somebody up for vagrancy, which we no longer recognize. Or
they don't have a vagrancy card anymore.
Right, or they pick somebody up for no tail light or something. But if we take and say that he reasonably suspects him of committing a crime, then my fears were quieted because I'm going to have fewer people have it. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, Keith Burns isn't objecting to reason suspects that he has committed a crime, and Milbank's objection was or is about to commit a crime.
Keith's objection would be quieted if we struck out or is about to commit a crime. Is that right, Keith?
I guess so. I certainly won't vote for it along with that.
Judas Priest. That means you got to really slaughter the guy before the policeman can...
No, he'd be committing an assault the minute he drew the gun.
Right.
That's a crime in the officer's presence.
Then an assault.
In the movies, they're awful fast on that pulling the guns on us.
Well, the guys I've seen with guns, they don't know which end to point usually.
And that goes for the police as well.
Well, that's what I thought we were talking about. I don't know any criminals. I had to be talking about police.
The ordinary thing we're talking about is he puts his hand in his pocket and has some drugs or something like that.
Is this word about to commit no place in the present statutes?
No.
No, that's new language. As I indicated, I submit it's better than what the Supreme Court said in Terry, where they said criminal activity may be afoot.
That's distinguished from horse tracking.
But in Terry, you see, the facts there were that the suspects were merely parked. They were in a car. They were parked in a neighborhood that, number one, had a high incidence of crime, and also the car had out-of-state plates, I believe, and it was late at night. The officer had no reason to believe they were committing a crime, but he did make inquiry of them. And of course, in order to make an inquiry, he had to detain them.
Madam Chairman.
Well, before you make your motion, Keith, I live on a kind of a dead end street back in the woods. And the other night, a carload of rough looking people came up and parked right in the front of my driveway, and they parked out there and scared the heck out of everybody. Under the Terry case, a district car could be dispatched and the officer might reasonably suspect that they were about to commit a crime and stop them and frisk them rather than waiting until they
But under that logic, there's nobody you could suspect of a crime.
It would still have to be reasonable. The officer would still have to show some grounds to bring him under our definition of reasonably suspects, hold the belief that's reasonable under the totality of the circumstances. Now, totality of the circumstances is language that we use in the use of force by an officer making an arrest in the criminal code. And it takes into account information that this officer may hold. That
are you reading from the text?
No, I'm ad-libbing.
Loud and clear for the record.
It takes into account, as it did under the use of allowing officers the use of force in making an arrest, the use of deadly force, precisely. That there are many things that come into play that an officer has taken into an account at the time he acts. And that is the locale, the time of day or night, the information he may hold as a result of prior reports, a description that he may have about a suspicious vehicle or a wanted subject, any number of things that may lead this officer. You put them all together and they spell reasonable suspicion for the purposes of stop and frisk, and for the purposes of an arrest using deadly force, they spell reasonable grounds to use deadly force. In other words, we didn't believe that the officer should wait until an individual takes a shot at him or until some assault has been made upon an officer because it's too difficult to articulate all the different kinds of circumstances that might occur. And so we use totality of the circumstances, and I submit that this draft would not authorize just a willy-nilly stopping of anybody that the officers wanted to stop under any circumstances. There's still to be some reasonable grounds.
Tom? Well, Keith, would you accept the Supreme Court language that reasonable suspicion and crimes afoot?
Well, coming from Eastern Oregon, you ought to include horseback.
You disagree with the Supreme Court.
No, I think there's another decision. There's another case.
I wouldn't. If you prefer to have reasonable suspicion crimes afoot, I'd go for that too. Yeah.
Okay. I haven't read the Terry case, and there's another case I want to read. I can't remember the name of it.
Maybe Judge Branch.
Cloman. Cloman was the companion, almost a companion case. It's an Oregon case. It's the closest thing we have in Oregon.
I'm thinking of a case
dealing
that was
with
cited
stopping
in
of a vehicle
by Judge Schwab recently in a United States Supreme Court case. I can't remember the name of it.
The other case was the Cybron case. Was similar to Terry. That's the United States Supreme Court case.
Well, the Frank Marion Keith case was almost a stop and frisk. I mean, in effect.
Do we have a motion?
No.
I move that we accept Section 31 as written.
There's been a motion that we accept Section 31 as it now stands. Discussion.
I'll second that
motion.
Sure, like a
foot.
I put that in 30.
I thought you were a cattleman instead of a sheep herder.
No, I want that foot.
I don't know whether it's germane discussion or not, but I think this language, I don't know what this language is going to
I think a foot is much more colorful.
Could jeopardize a lot of votes on the overall code.
Is a further discussion of Section 31. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator John Burns.
Aye.
Senator Keith Burns.
No.
Senator Ivers.
Aye.
Senator Hoyt.
Aye.
Senator Smith.
Aye.
Madam Chairman.
No.
Well, I just want to quote the Supreme Court. I would stick it in there. And then they have to fight the Supreme Court.
Anything for legitimacy. Don't you understand that?
Section 32.
This just goes on then to authorize the frisk after the stop has been made. And if I didn't point it out earlier, I want to make it clear that this draft, as we read the Terry case, a frisk does not automatically ensue or would automatically be authorized after the stop. If after the stop, then the officer reasonably suspects that the person is armed and presently dangerous to the officer or another person present, then he could go ahead and make the external patting of the... When they say stop and frisk, frequently individuals, I think, get the impression that one automatically follows the other, and that is, I do not think that is the law, and that is not meant to be the law under this proposal.
But supposing that he does start to frisk, then if he feels a bag in the pocket, he's authorized to take the bag and look inside.
Well,
what if he feels a package of cigarettes?
Well, those are difficult questions to answer, Senator. Whether or not this would give rise to reasonable suspicion that this is a weapon or something. We speak to that in our commentary to some extent, I think. State versus Hall, we cited in the 1970 Court of Appeals case. That was a BBR arrest. So, and we just cited for the purposes that there was a baggy pocket, and the officer there asked if the defendant had a gun, and the defendant said yes. But we cite the case because we say here the baggy pocket and the hand in the pocket would be reason enough under Terry to justify the frisk. And then also State versus Fisher. Well, involved a protective search. But the baggy situation, unless you could show that that there was reason to believe this was a weapon, I don't think reasonable search.
But once you embark on the search, if you find something, you can proceed, can't you? Once you embark on the frisk. So you feel a balloon in the guy's pocket. Then can you go ahead and require him to hand over the balloon?
I don't think you can under a stop and frisk provision. No, I don't.
You think it's strictly limited to weapons?
Yes.
Section 33.
Well, this is basically what we have in the law now. We did put in attempted theft in here. This is the detention interrogation. This statute was amended also last session by the Supreme Court. Because originally this was a shoplifting provision. It's to authorize a reasonable interrogation of a person where there's, you'll notice, reasonable cause for believing is the language used there. And I don't know whether there or you want to put probable cause.
Well, the motion originally adopted was to replace reasonable cause all throughout the bill with probable cause.
But here we're not talking about an arrest. We're talking about detention.
My view would be that because this is a subject of great abuse, probable cause probably should be substituted.
Well, I think our first motion takes care of it.
Yes.
The other thing that concerns me in this is that while you've extended this to attempted theft, that doesn't seem like much, but then you see who can detain people for attempted theft.
Oh, we discussed that. Right.
And it disturbs me to have a
store employee.
Yes, but I mean, what purpose does it serve to detain a person for attempted theft? They don't have any, it's just, I did, you did, I did not. Situation. You did, I did not. You know, it isn't like catching with something on them. I can, that's reasonable to me. When they've seen them take something, go from the store, catch them outside the store, leaving the area of the store, which the law now permits them. Then you've got some evidence. But what about a person who lifts something up, he sees the store employee, puts it back down, and he leaves the store? What's the purpose of detaining a person?
Well, now wait a minute. the corpus delicti of the crime of theft isn't committed until the person walks through the door out onto the street.
They don't have to. I think they can leave the area.
Yes, yeah, no, they have to leave the store.
Have to leave the store. So,
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
You have to pass through the cash register stand and
get outside.
Well, but you can have a cash register stand in an area of the store. You go to a totally different part of the store. I think that's sufficient.
Well, I've won cases in municipal court where they arrested them and they hadn't left the store and they had a bunch of items in the bag. They said, well, I was, you know, and the crime hadn't been committed because they hadn't walked outside with it.
In Lane County, they hold that the owner of the store has to see the act. Can't be an employee.
Well, my argument doesn't go to that anyway. It's that even if they do go outside the store, whatever it is, when they attempt to find, I don't see the purpose of it.
Well, I suppose this is what the rationale was. We got Fred Myers at 21st and Burnside, and somebody walks in, snips a chain on a TV set or a stereo or a cassette or something there, and starts walking toward the exit with it, and the gendarme sees him and takes up pursuit. The guy drops the item and starts running. Okay. He has a bag or something under his arm, which would give the officer reasonable cause to suspect there might be something else in that. The use of attempted theft there would permit you to pursue him and stop him and interrogate him.
Well, what do you even need that for? You can go out and arrest him. You witness him committing a crime. Any private citizen see that situation, arrest the guy.
Well, not if he dropped it before he got out of the store.
So I'm in the process of committing a crime.
Well, if I may, Senator.
Go ahead.
On this, I think that Section 33, under the old provision, under 133.037, as well as the way it was amended last time, and as we propose to amend this time, I think can really work to the advantage of an individual.
An individual?
An individual under these circumstances where they can just go ahead and arrest him, because if you authorize a reasonable interrogation by a store employee or a security officer, and he is then satisfied that there's no shoplifting going on, it could well avoid an arrest.
You ever know of a case where they were trying
to avoid an arrest? Yes, I know of cases where there's been interrogation and then individuals have been released. In fact,
happens all the time, sir. Known shoplifters. They just stop them at the door. Take all their stuff. Put it back on the shelves.
Well, I realize that there's a very serious situation where a lot of places are being put out of business by shoplifters, usually juveniles. It's a very serious thing, but I'm not sure that's the way to reach it.
My point is that giving the suspected individual an opportunity to explain himself may not necessarily be to his detriment. It may keep him from being arrested. Obviously, this section is... I'm not suggesting that's the purpose behind this section, but I think it can work that way. The purpose behind this section is to protect the people making the inquiry from a lawsuit or from a charge of...
But as Keith said, 90% of this is used against kids. They write it out and say, sign here, and that's it.
I don't know about the percentage.
I don't have as much of a problem with the distinction that you draw, Keith, between theft and attempted theft as I do with the problem of permitting the stopping detention and interrogation by a store employee. The biggest weapon that I guess we have against arbitrary use of that is the false arrest weapon. I have struggled with this intellectually.
Kids don't bring false arrest.
No, but on the other hand, every case I've had in my office in the last couple of years with regard to stopping and detention at Fred Meyer or Meyer and Frank or those places involving kids has involved a telephone call to the parents rather than a criminal prosecution. I've struggled with this thing intellectually, and the way the old statute was, we never used it when I was in the DA's office. We always prosecuted them for larceny in a store and stayed away from that shoplifting statute completely.
Well,
I don't, as far as the commission is concerned, we don't feel that strongly about attempted theft. We felt that it was advisable to try to clarify any ambiguity under this section. As a matter of fact, I think that under the consolidated theft statute that make a strong argument that whether or not you've left the store with the property, you're still, if all other things being present, the other elements of the crime are there and you can establish them, you'd have the crime of theft anyway, whether they left the store or not.
Well, how about in Fred Meyer's, if you pick up an article and then wander to another counter before you go to the cash stand, is that attempted theft?
No, I wouldn't think so.
But could they question you for attempted theft?
Well, under this proposal, I think they probably could question you. Question whether that amounts to reasonable cause. That's kind of a judgment call, and I'm not sure whether a court would hold that that would be reasonable cause to believe that attempted theft was afoot.
to clear up any ambiguity, and because I'll move to strike or attempted theft in both subsections.
It's been moved by Senator John Burns to delete or attempted theft in section 33 on page 13 of the bill on lines 25 and 26 and 30 and 31. Discussion. Clerk call the roll.
Senator John Burns.
Aye.
Senator Kiefer? Aye. Senator Ivers? Aye. Senator Hoyt? No. Senator Smith? No. Madam Chairman?
Aye.
That brings us to the end of the section on pre-arraignment and investigation, isn't it? No. No, it doesn't.
Well,
the rest of this, Senator Brown, is existing law, except I would call your attention to a couple of things. Number one, section 34, as it appears in the yellow book, I rewrote just for drafting purposes in the bill. That appears on page 14 of the bill. And I wrote it one way for the purpose of the report because I felt it was more understandable, but technically the bill version is the proper way to add this, as I call it, boilerplate provision that relates to prevention of crimes by public officers. Then from then on, there is no change in the existing law up through section 40.
This is all old law?
This is, yes, this is all existing law. And it really does, the rest of it, what appears in your yellow book is sections 35 through 40, do not even appear in the bill.
That says it repeals 145.040, 501.20, and 310. What's that?
Those,
which one did you say it repeals? What's over there?
140.50. The 040, is that the one on page 32 of the book?
Yeah.
In the middle, under commentary, the first sentence says, "This draft repeals."
Yes, those are the peace bond statutes where you can if you think someone who is going to commit a crime, you can go to a magistrate or the district attorney and ask him to go to the magistrate and have the person cited in and put under a bond. Which would be broken if he commits the offense that he is suspected of planning. We think it's bad law. It's doesn't really add anything to the law.
It's never used.
Rarely used. It's.
What about the wife whose husband is beating her up? Does this take away her power to get a peace bond?
Well, it would take away her power to get a peace bond. She could still get a restraining order, however, it doesn't affect any civil remedy she would have for a restraining order. It's just kind of under the peace bond, you would forfeit the monetary amount the court sets. We think it's bad law. It's been on the books for probably, well, I think it's on the books since about, it's the inception of the criminal procedure code.
Senator Keithburn.
Was ORS 145.020, which is section 35 on page 30, was that the creation of the criminal law revision committee, or was it existing law prior to that?
Section 35?
Yeah.
No, that is, that's existing law.
I know it's existing law, but is it existing as of last session?
No, this was enacted the previous session, as I recall. This was the 69th session enacted this.
Yeah, I think that's one of the worst statutes in the whole criminal code.
This was the, in fact, this received quite a bit of attention during the 69th session, as I recall.
Yeah, that's wild.
I think that could be cleaned up a lot by taking out the word unlawfully on the second line, which I don't know what it means, and I don't think it can be defined very well. And in the last sentence in sub 2.
Is that a motion?
That's so moved.
Senator Keith Burns moves.
I guess it should be R. Take out the word unlawfully and or.
Senator Keith Burns moves in section 35 of the yellow book on page 30 to take out the words unlawful or, and in sub 2 to delete the last sentence.
Madam Chairman, it should be R unlawfully rather than lawfully or. In the second line of sub 1.
No, it should be unlawfully or.
I don't think so. You're putting any five or more persons,
are
whether armed or not, or riotously assembled?
Are.
Oh, okay. I guess you're right, John. I guess you're right.
Why do you do that?
Pardon me?
Why?
Well, unlawfully, I suppose, could be.
They don't have a park permit.
It could be. And any city ordinance or anything else could be the basis of it.
Right. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think there ought to be some standards set. I think there's for purpose of committing a riot or something, it's fine, but I don't think it's because we have a park permit.
Have a discussion now.
Discussion.
Well,
Senator Hoyt.
I'm a little bit confused. John, you said that we worked on this in our last session.
No, he said we did not.
69.
This was these were the Senate amendments to House Bill 1880.
Well, what I'm wondering about, Madam Chairman, spoke about border plate. The from time immemorial, there's been a statute someplace or another or applied that in case of riotous situation that police had rather extraordinary powers.
This retains riotous.
Leave riot in there.
Unlawful or. So it reads dispersal of riotous assemblies when any five or more persons, whether armed or not, are riotously assembled and so on.
All right. I would move to divide the questions, and I could, unless I could be persuaded otherwise, could perhaps be supportive of the first part, but I would suggest that deletion of the last sentence of subsection 2 would absolutely render everything ineffectual, and I would support leaving that in.
Well, I'm willing to divide the question.
Huh?
I'm willing to divide the question.
All right. The question is divided, then. The first question before us is to delete the words unlawfully or in sub 1 of section 35.
What page is this on?
It's not in the bill.
Not in here at all.
It's just in the yellow book.
Madam Chairman.
Yes, Senator Smith.
Oh, it's not in the
bill. Keith,
no, they don't put in the existing law in the bill.
All right.
Senator Smith.
Keith, I'm interested in your thoughts about eliminating this. In other words, what you're saying is that you don't believe that a city or a county should, by rule or regulation, limit those people over five who might assemble for any purpose other than riotously assemble, which is an act that they might commit, I suppose, is after the fact. In other words, you don't think they should be able to limit prior to that act assembly of five or more people.
No, I don't
even
that.
Even if there were a stated purpose for the action.
No,
which
they
might.
No, they might. You might state some purposes that I would go along with.
Don, have we got any definition of riotous? Or?
Well, we have a definition of riot in the criminal code. We have the crime of riot.
Which is what? what chapter?
John, you've got this in
the
book. It's probably easier to work from.
It's on offenses
against
the
code of the
public justice.
No.
I think
just
the way
procedure
it shows
part.
Up there. I can't
think
exactly.
Part, have it all.
166.
I'd like to correct something I said earlier, looking back over these sections. Section 35, 145.020 was not enacted in 69. This goes way back. That's the old riot, the so-called Riot Act statute.
You
that
know,
authorizes, it's based on common law, where it authorizes a peace officer to read the Riot Act to an assembly. Tell
yeah.
them to change
it. I always thought the
okay. then I'm wrong.
Term, just unlawful assembly by itself, I always thought that was been ruled in the Constitution
well,
a long time
well,
ago.
Wait a minute.
And I was surprised by
the 69 material appears in the following sections: exclusion from public property, and this dealt with the authorizing the governor to proclaim an emergency, and it was really directed at that time towards disturbances on campuses. This was, and those are, as they show here, sections 37 through 40. Section 35 is, that's very old law. We do not have the crime of unlawful assembly. That was...
What's that?
Prior to the new criminal code, there was an attempt to define the crime of unlawful assembly, but the old statute didn't have a penalty provision, and the Supreme Court held, therefore, that with no penalty, there was no crime. Senate Bill 40 did propose the crime of unlawful assembly. That was deleted by the legislature. In the last session, the theory being that you had attempted riot, if you had anything, and it would be covered.
Well, Don, what is this if it isn't a...
What?
It's... Is there a distinction between a refusal to disperse an unlawful assembly?
Riot. 166.015.
What's the difference if a police officer come up and tell five people to scatter, and they don't scatter and they arrest them and have something that says they cannot assemble unlawfully?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure there is a difference.
That's what this does. Though.
To that extent, what you're suggesting, Senator, I think is consistent with what was done with respect to the substantive crime of unlawful assembly. I think that...
Here's the definition of riot. A person commits a crime of riot if, while participating with five or more other persons, he engages in tumultuous and violent conduct and thereby intentionally or recklessly creates a grave risk of causing public alarm.
What happens every night at the beverages? Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Smith,
are you saying that this language then is superfluous?
I think the unlawfully part is, yes. I don't think it's taking it out. I think it's consistent with what the criminal code.
Let me ask you what that would do. It wasn't Klamath County that came up with a provision that not more than 3,000 people could assemble at one time when the Asians were all coming over for a supposedly spiritual rock festival. You remember that?
Yeah. I thought you were talking about the Democratic Pre-Primary Convention.
Well,
that's why I was only by
invitation to
cut down the number.
It wasn't the Communist Party at all.
You know, lost your train of thought,
yeah,
didn't
you? that provision would now, if you took this language out, would not... Would not hold, is that right?
Well,
now, the 3,000, you can do that anyway to prevent them from assembling under the First Amendment.
Home Rule County could pass an ordinance, couldn't it, to that effect?
Against the Constitution?
To
restrict for health purposes. This is for health purposes. They didn't have the facilities.
Well, I think the county ordinance would be subject to the same test that a state law would be. I don't think there's much question about that.
Well, let me set the record straight and say that when I said this related to House Bill 1880, I was mistaken. You're correct when you say that the language that appears in Section 35 is of older vintage. But if I understand you correctly and me correctly, since we deleted the so-called crime of unlawful assembly because the Supreme Court said it wasn't a crime because there wasn't any penalty, to that extent, the words unlawfully are or presently have no stature in the criminal code and are surplusage. Is that correct?
No.
All right.
However, I would agree with Senator Burns, or Keith Burns, to the extent that under 145.020, you could have a crime stated. If you read the Riot Act and they don't disperse, then 145.0, I think it's 090, creates a penalty provision for that.
No, there is no 090.
Or, excuse me, 990.
That's right.
165.990?
145.990.
Well, for the purpose, the crime in 990 says for that it's a crime if sub 2 is violated. Sub 2 says, for purpose of arresting or causing the arrest of persons who fail to disperse, the arresting officer may command. Well,
the Bar Committee, I know, mentioned that.
Is it out on that one?
The Bar Committee proposed, in addition to the repealer sections, to delete they propose to delete Section 35, 145.020, and also 145.990. The theory being that riot is already prohibited under the criminal code, and that to the extent that this prohibits unlawful assembly, it should be repealed. So this is also in the criminal law committee's statement made. This
further discussion on the question of deleting the words unlawful or.
Because this appeared in 145, which is a procedural section. Riot appeared.
Any further discussion? Court call the roll.
Senator John Graham.
I'm going to vote aye on the first part.
We're voting unlawful or.
All right.
Senator Keith Green.
Aye.
Senator Ivers.
No.
Senator Voigt.
No.
Senator Smith.
No.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. The amendment fails. Do you want to go through with the second amendment?
Yes.
The second amendment is to delete in the yellow book ORS 145.020 the last sentence in sub 2. Discussion?
Well, Madam Chairman, what occurs in a situation of this type is that there be people, and I think of a particular situation in Portland where there will be a large number of young people and they're known to each other. There's some who obviously are instigators of the difficulties, they've committed a crime, not a very serious one. They've don't have a permit to hold an assembly or something in a park, and while their friends are on the scene, they're not participating in the activities, they don't condone what they're going to do, but they'd be might be in danger, and they certainly would be ostracized the rest of their life in the rather small community they live if they did in fact do what the police officer asked them to do. The other thing is that the police don't really intend them to do that anyway. They ask them to do it because they can't prove who instigated it anyway, and they use this as a device to gather the whole crew up and haul them down to the police station and charge them with an offense. This is what happened in the Columbia Park case, John.
Well,
Columbia
Park.
Senator White.
There seems to be a dichotomy here. If there's a riot and a police officer appears or a public official appears and says disperse, then you're supposed to get the heck out of there. Now, if you don't get the heck out of there, if you do get the heck out of there, how are you going to help arrest the rest of them? So the point is, this is double jeopardy.
No, they told them to leave, or they'd be arrested as another man.
I've learned here.
Well,
judge.
All right.
I think it's contradictory.
I'm going to only make a comment.
Senator John Burns.
I prosecuted the first case back in about 63 or 4 where there was a riot at a football game between Jefferson and Washington. The police officers went onto the school grounds to try to get these kids dispersed, and 5 of them went on motorcycles, and 2 of them ended up having to be permanently retired from the police department because of disabilities they received there. I think the police has to have some type of a mechanism in order to require these people to disperse. And this is quite apart from the distinction between unlawfully or riotously. But if there is a riot, and in force and effect, there has to be some mechanism to command obedience with the dispersal order. So as a matter of public policy, it seems to me that if you take that out, there is no such mechanism. And I think it was highly appropriate in that case for the kids to be... Yeah, we've processed, they were processed, some of them were prosecuted. It was highly appropriate to round them up. I mean, there was a bad situation. So I,
Senator
I,
Iverson.
Just a matter of law.
In relation to what Senator Hoyt said, the officer had first requested to disperse, so if they left, then they wouldn't be in a position of being asked to help. So this request for aid comes only after they have refused to disperse.
Necessarily, maybe they don't ask them to disperse. They ask
well,
the
well then he can't ask for their aid. It says for the purpose of arresting or causing arrest who failed to disperse so before he can ask for their aid.
If you put that in there,
that's in there.
It's in there.
No, where did it say that?
First sentence.
The purpose of section
sub
two.
The purpose of arresting or causing arrest for failed to disperse.
So he has already asked them to leave and they haven't gone.
Well, it doesn't mean they've asked the person of whom he's asking the aid.
Senator, the way I read too, I think what they're talking about, they're not talking about the rioters or the suspected unlawful assemblers or whatever you want to call them. Sub 2 gives authority to the officer to ask other persons to help him disperse this unlawful assembly. It doesn't seem reasonable to me to think that he's going to, in one breath, command them to leave, and then if they don't, the next breath, ask them to help him break up their own assembly. I mean, I think we're talking about his requesting the aid of other persons, third persons, who are not unlawfully assembled.
If they're completely separated, but usually they're not.
It says all of them.
I would like to make one other point, if I may. Now, with respect to that last sentence in sub 2, we have a crime in the new criminal code, ORS 162-245. It's not a crime, really, it's a violation. Refusing to assist a peace officer. And it provides that a person commits the offense of refusing to assist a peace officer if, upon command by a person known by him to be a peace officer, he unreasonably refuses or fails to assist in effecting an unauthorized arrest or preventing another from committing a crime. I think it's already covered.
I'm going to make a motion.
Well, we have a motion. We have a motion to delete the last sentence of sub 2 of ORS 145.020. Now, do you want to amend the proposed amendment?
All right, I know that you feel strongly about this. This isn't in the present code. It isn't in the bill. And so I'm going to vote against the proposed amendment, but I'll vote to authorize committee introduction of a separate bill to delete ORS 145.020. It would be a one-line bill. And
well,
then it would keep this out of the criminal code.
All right, then this should reflect back on the thing we already adopted. Oh, we didn't adopt it.
No, we
just failed. Okay.
No, section 35 is in the bill.
I suppose that would be a better way to proceed. Anyhow.
You withdraw your motion.
I withdraw both motions, even the one that failed.
Are you making a motion for the committee to introduce a bill?
John Burns has.
John Burns has. Have you?
You want to lose?
All right. John Burns has moved that a bill be introduced as we've been discussing. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Fail.
All right. My heart's in the right place for it. I move we approve Article
Local
2
government
as a
local
government
will do it too.
I will.
All right, it's been a move.
Power of leadership.
It's been moved that we approve Article 2 as amended.
Let's see.
Or that we adopt Article 2 as amended.
Okay.
It's completed on page 14 of the bill. Discussion.
Page is finished in the yellow book.
In the book it's on page 35, and in the bill it's on page 14. Discussion of the motion. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator John Burns.
Aye.
Senator Keith Burns.
No.
Senator Iverson.
Aye.
Senator Hoyt.
Aye.
Senator Smith.
Aye.
Madam Chairman.
No. next one is grand jury.
Stop and frisk.
Article 3.
Problem.
If we take a half an hour recess, we all be back at 3:30.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. We go to rules.
Wonderful. Yeah. I gotta go to rules.
Okay.
We're going to election.
We take up at 3:30.
I gotta go to alcohol and drugs.
I gotta go to the restroom.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
Yeah, I know that. I said I wouldn't.
What happens to the section? Okay, now we got to get. If the section fails, does that mean that the court's incomplete?